Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien, and joining me today once again is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about the rise of Lapsus, a new extortion gang on the block that has carried out a wave of high-profile attacks. And we'll also be taking a look at some new tactics being deployed by the Bazaar backdoor malware. But first, let's turn to the invasion of Ukraine, because the impact of the conflict has been enormous and its effects have been felt far beyond the region. For example, Bridget, in the US, a number of cybersecurity warnings have been issued by the authorities over there.
Yeah, so just this week, actually, we saw the White House issue a new warning about potential Russian cyber attacks targeting critical infrastructure in the US. And, you know, this isn't the first warning of this type we've seen coming from the White House. But US President Joe Biden said in a statement that there was evolving intelligence that the Russian government is exploring options for potential cyber attacks aimed at US critical infrastructure. And the president said that while his administration would do whatever it could to protect critical infrastructure organizations against cyber attacks, he also did point out that most critical infrastructure in the US is actually owned and operated by the private sector. And so he said that these organizations must accelerate their efforts to, as he put it, lock their digital doors. And he urged companies in the sector who have not already done so to harden their cyber defenses immediately. We then saw a similar warning issued the following day by the UK's National Cybersecurity Centre, the NCSC, which said that it backed the White House's call for increased cybersecurity vigilance among critical infrastructure organizations in response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that while it was unaware of specific targeted threats to the UK resulting from Russia's, you know, activity in Ukraine, it did recommend that organizations do bolster their cybersecurity by following guidance that the NCSC has previously published earlier this year as a priority.
And speaking of critical infrastructure, there was a specific warning that was issued to satellite communications providers in the last week or so as well, was there?
Yeah, so the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, and the FBI, they last week, so before, I suppose, President Biden's more kind of wide-ranging statement, they issued a joint security advisory that urged US and international satellite communications, SATCOM, network providers and their customers to stay alert for possible threats. And they advise SATCOM providers and their customers to review and to implement the mitigations that were in the advisory in order to improve their network security, with the advice including using things like multi-factor authentication for all accounts with access to SATCOM networks, as well as putting in place additional traffic monitoring on these networks as well. And this advisory did follow an investigation into disruption of broadband and satellite internet access that occurred in Ukraine just as the Russian invasion began, which left tens of thousands of people then without internet access. And CISA and the FBI, they also issued another warning last week about Russia-sponsored attackers attempting to access networks through misconfigured default multi-factor authentication protocols. And they warned that the attackers in this case were following on from their initial intrusion by exploiting a known critical Windows principle of vulnerability that we've spoken about before, which is called Print Nightmare, to then run arbitrary code on the systems. And this advisory gave an example of an NGO that was targeted in May last year. So this activity has been going on for a little while by Russian actors who took advantage of a misconfigured MFA account to enroll a new device for MFA. And the attackers then went on to access cloud and email accounts within the organization. And in this advisory, CISA and the FBI, they advise organizations to ensure that their MFA is set up correctly across the organization and that all known vulnerabilities are patched, and also that all inactive accounts are promptly and properly disabled on the system as well. And Dick, I mean, that's kind of a bit of a broader outlook on what's happening, but I know we've spoken previously about attacks against Ukraine itself. So have we seen anything going on in that kind of line in the past week or so?
I guess yes and no is the answer to that. I've explained why. As we all know, the invasion was preceded by a wave of cyber attacks that involved this destructive disk wiping malware. this malware that's been called by some vendors Hermetic Wiper. It effectively rendered the infected computer unusable, and the attackers, they also deployed ransomware against the victim's networks. And the ransomware was there to kind of act as a decoy or a distraction from the true purpose of the attack. So that's what happened the night before the shooting started. And I guess everybody has been bracing themselves for more because they're aware of, I guess, the background of attacks against Ukraine going over the past few years, and they're aware of the Russian cyber capability. But for now, nothing of the same order of magnitude has been seen. However, like, we really have to stress that that isn't to say there has been no activity. There's been, for example, a smaller number of disk wiping attacks that have occurred since then. So there's a few examples. On March 14th, ESET blogged about a new wiper they'd found that wasn't really related to the previous wiper. They called it Caddy Wiper. And they said that had been used against what they termed a limited number of organizations in Ukraine. And then we ourselves saw a variant of Hermetic Wiper, the original wiper, being deployed against an organization also on March 15th. And then just this week, we saw another variant of Hermetic Wiper being attempted to be used against an organization that was originally targeted in the pre-invasion wave of attacks. But I guess even more importantly, the normal day-to-day Russian-sponsored attacks against Ukraine have continued unabated. And when I say normal, I guess with regard to Ukraine, normal is quite a high level of activity, relatively speaking, to any other country. So what does that mean? It means lots and lots of phishing campaigns, attempting to spread malware. This is something we've seen ourselves, and third parties have reported it too. And then there's also, third party reports of disinformation campaigns going on in the country. Some of the activity that we've seen can be definitively tied to Shookworm, also known as Gamerreddon. That's a Russian-sponsored group that specializes in attacking Ukraine. And it's probably quite a reasonable assumption that Shookworm is involved in quite a high proportion of this activity. So all of that prompts a number of questions, one of them being kind of, is that it? Were the fears of more widespread or more destructive cyber activity, were they unfounded? And I think I would advise caution in that viewpoint, because from everything we know from reading the news about the invasion in general, I think there may have been an assumption on the Russian side of things that this was going to be a quick war. And so maybe they only had the kind of initial wave of cyber operations planned. And now that they're kind of resetting their strategy for a longer war, further things could be in the pipeline. But having said that, I know there's been a lot of information coming out about how hard Ukraine worked to harden its infrastructure and try and protect itself from these kinds of cyber attacks. And I guess another question it prompts is whether, once you're into a real, horrifically destructive war that we're seeing at the moment, how effective are cyber attacks going to be? when artillery shells and bombs are probably much more effective at destroying infrastructure than any cyber attack could be. But I think, it's one of these situations where, I still think caution is to be advised, and it shouldn't be assumed that the cyber phase of this war is over just yet.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
Yeah, and I know, we've talked a lot about this situation on the podcast, but there's so so many different outcomes and so many impacts that it's having. And one of the things that I guess a lot of people may not have thought of was the impact, I guess, on Russia itself, because all of the international cloud providers are pulling out.
Yeah, of course. Like, and this is obviously as a result of the many sanctions that, you know, different countries have, I suppose, issued against Russia since this invasion began, which obviously has led to many companies pulling their activity out of Russia. But yeah, some of those companies were, as you said, cloud providers. So it was reported last week that Russia actually looks set to face a pretty critical IT storage crisis due to those cloud providers pulling out of the country. And reports have claimed that Russia could actually be in danger of running out of data storage in as little as 2 months' time. So Bleeping Computer shared a report from the Russian news outlet Kommersant, which said that this claim came out at a meeting that was held in Russia's Ministry of Digital Transformation, and that was reportedly attended by representatives of numerous large Russian companies like Sberbank and Rostelecom, Atomdata and Yandex. So it appears that the sanctions that have been imposed since Russia's invasion of Ukraine have meant that basically that Russian organizations have had to turn to domestic cloud storage providers, obviously, due to the international providers pulling out, with the locally sourced storage capacity needs of Russian mobile carrier Megaphone reportedly increasing fivefold, according, and telecoms company MTS tenfold, while social network VK reportedly had to seek 20% more storage resources in just 1 week. So the Russian government is reported to be exploring various solutions to this IT storage problem, including, you know, leasing all available domestic data storage and basically seizing the IT resources that were left behind by businesses that have pulled out of the country. While local media in Russia has also reported that the country is considering the option of attempting to kind of tap into Chinese cloud service providers and IT system sellers. But obviously, you know, this is currently a bit complicated because, you know, China does not appear to have really decided how willing it is to support Russia yet as this conflict kind of continues. And there were also reports, I think, that there was considerations being given to kind of curtailing people's access to, I guess, streaming services and entertainment kind of services via the internet that obviously take up a lot of this kind of storage, which I'm sure would be pretty unpopular with the people in Russia in general. So yeah, it's just kind of one of these, I suppose, it's not an unintended consequence, but it's a consequence I guess people wouldn't think of, I guess.
Not an obvious consequence, I guess maybe is the word, you know. And it's interesting, all right, because you know, it's infrastructure that you can't build overnight. So if it continues, if the sanctions continue, it's going to be a big problem for companies in Russia.
Yeah, I guess it's one of these things that it's going to have an impact on, I mean, business and regular people over there, and just I suppose another impact and, you know, thing that people aren't likely to be very happy is happening. But anyway, let's move on to the other big cybersecurity news story of this week. And that is a pretty big story. It is the rise of a group that's called itself Lapsus, which is a cybercrime group who carried out, you know, a string of attacks. The latest high profile one being against Microsoft, from whom they have stole source code.
Yeah, Lapsus has been around for a little while now, but it almost feels like they've just come out of nowhere, because within a very short space of time, they've managed to attack a lot of big name companies and have been very quick to advertise that fact. So let's start with who Lapsus are, maybe. And I guess you could best describe them as an extortion gang. That's because while they do hold their victims to ransom, they don't appear to actually use ransomware to do so. And they instead rely on threatening to release the data that they have stolen from their victims. So Lapsus is not the first gang to kind of eschew the encryption business model, for want of a better word, completely. But it very much remains a niche tactic, and I think it may be the only kind of high profile group like this who started out like that. There are cases of ransomware groups who just stopped encrypting and just went on to pure data theft, but they did start out in the ransomware business. Then the second thing to note about them is they are not shy whatsoever. They seem to court and indeed revel in publicity. And you sort of get the impression that for them, it's as much about the notoriety they achieve as it is about any money they earn. And I'm not sure how much money they've earned or if they have. So while lots of ransomware groups, they think that the mainstay is the darknet, that they rely for communications and posting stolen data. Lapsus uses Telegram. They've got their own channel, and they announce details on who their victims are with screenshots of what they claim to have access or what they've stolen. And they even do stuff like running polls on which organization's data that they should release next. And, at times they've kind of appeared a bit, reckless or erratic. I'm not sure what the right word is. They really got public attention when they breached the chip maker NVIDIA. And afterwards, their first demand was that they remove an anti-crypto mining feature called Light Hash Rate from its GPUs. And then they kind of changed their mind and they said, oh, well, actually, we want you to publicly release drivers for some of your chips. It's kind of unusual set of demands that you'd see from attackers like this. So then this week, a lot happened. They announced that they breached Microsoft and they had stolen some source code. And they also said that they breached Okta, which is an authentication services provider that's used by a lot of companies. So for Microsoft, the company acknowledged that it has been breached. They said it was only a single account that had been compromised, and that granted what they described as limited access. So what Lapsus claimed to have stolen was released in an archive. And it contained what appeared to be most of the Bing Maps source code and about half the Bing and Cortana code. Now, Microsoft did say that it does not rely on the secrecy of its code as a security measure, and viewing source code does not lead to an elevation of risk. So it's important to clarify that. Then with Okta, the company initially indicated that the breach was confined to the compromise of an account at a third-party customer support engineer who was working for one of its contractors called Sitel. However, they subsequently elaborated on the nature of the incident, and I guess kind of like the next report really kind of explained it all, like exactly what the impact was. So they said that what happened was there was a 5-day window before the compromise, between when the compromise occurred and when it was discovered. So in that 5-day period, the attackers had access to the Sitel environment, and they worked out that a maximum of 2.5% approximately of its customers had their Okta tenant accessed by Sitel during that time period. So what they're saying is that, it's possible that 2.5% were breached, but it could have been less than that. That's the access they had anyway.
Okay, so I think Lapsus, it's fair to say, has really skyrocketed into people's attention after the Okta Microsoft incidents this week. But they have managed to carry out really a lot of very high-profile attacks in really a very short space of time. I mean, certainly it's all since the start of this year, really, I think, that these kind of high-profile attacks have occurred. But do we know anything much at all, really, about how they're doing this, like how they're carrying out these attacks?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. How has a group that has sprung from obscurity managed to carry out these attacks? And we do know a fair amount, actually. So, for example, Microsoft put out a report on Tuesday in the aftermath of their breach, and it pretty much summarizes most of the things that are known about Lapsus' DGB's tool tactics and tools, tactics and procedures. So I should stress that this information, it seems it was gleaned from multiple Lapsus attacks, and it's not like everything didn't occur just in the attack on Microsoft. You know, it's like basically everything they know about them. And from that, I guess the third thing that is noteworthy about Lapsus emerges, and that really is that their TTPs are very different from most cybercrime groups. None of them in themselves are novel. It's more that the overall mix or composition of their TTPs is unusual. So the big takeaway is really that they make very heavy use of social engineering. And while they do use malware, the heavy lifting is done really by social engineering. And that's often their gateway in to the organizations that they target. Second takeaway is that they do their homework. It's obvious that they have obtained a really deep understanding of how big organizations work, the systems that they use, the processes and all that sort of thing. And then they make the most of that knowledge. So let's look at initial access for a start. They use a range of tactics to get onto networks. That can include buying credentials or session tokens on underground forums. They advertise for and pay employees to hand over their credentials or their multi-factor authentication. So essentially they're buying their way in. They've also been known to use SIM swapping to facilitate account takeover. SIM swapping, I think we've talked about it before, but it's been a while since we did it. That's essentially where you persuade a cell phone carrier to reissue a new SIM to you rather than the original owner. So there's an element of social engineering involved in it. You ring up the network carrier and you say, oh, I've lost my SIM, or I need a new SIM, here's my new address, and they send it out to you. And then it means that the target's phone number, you have control of the target's phone number. And that's very useful because somebody's cell phone number is often a key component for identity theft. So the very simple example would be a two-factor authentication, where they will send an SMS message with a one-time code to verify a login. So if you have that person's mobile phone number, they'll get the SMS message with the code. Other things they do is apparently they have targeted and accessed employees' personal accounts, usually email accounts, and rifled through them to see if they could find any useful information or credentials. They've used the Redline password stealer to steal credentials and session tokens. And they've also gone through public source code repositories to see if anyone's made any mistakes and exposed credentials in their code. And then once that's the way in, once they're on a network, there's a wide range again of TTPs that they use to elevate privileges, to move laterally and to steal the data. So that could be exploiting unpatched vulnerabilities on internal servers. The applications mentioned were things like Jira, GitLab, Confluence, all applications that big IT organizations will use these days. Again, internal code repositories and collaboration platforms, they'll search for other confidential information. They've been using a tool called AD Explorer that is used to enumerate all the users and groups on a network. They've also been getting into things like Slack or Teams, which lots of organizations use, to see if they can find any useful information there, if anyone's posted credentials. And they've also used kind of the more traditional credential stealing tools, such as Mimikatz. It made calls to internal help desks, pretending to be employees to try and, get passwords reset and things like that. And even in some cases, and I think this is pretty pretty audacious, they've managed to join internal crisis communications calls to understand what the incident response workflows are at that company. And then exfiltrating data. They have their own dedicated infrastructure in known VPS providers, and they appear to use NordVPN for their egress points. So like a huge range of tactics there, you know, lots of stuff that they can try, and you know, if one fails, that they've other avenues to explore. But it really shows the depth of their knowledge of how things work in these companies.
Yeah, it's a very interesting group, really, and its activity. I just found that what you were saying there about them, like buying paying employees for access to their credentials, is pretty interesting. I remember we saw some of the ransomware groups last year kind of threatening to do that, but we didn't find any evidence that it was actually happening. So it's pretty interesting if Lapsus is actually using that as one of its initial infection vectors. But yeah, definitely one to watch for sure.
Yeah, it certainly is, because exactly, you're never really sure whether ransomware operators were successful in doing this, but in Lapsus's case, it seems to be. And they do present a real challenge in terms of protecting yourself, because you're fighting a battle on multiple fronts. You know, it's not just protecting yourself against the tools they use. It's about hardening your infrastructure, making sure everything is patched, making sure you've got good MFA there. But then the whole social engineering side of it is, you know, it's like, you know, it's as much a human problem as it is an IT or a security problem of trying to educate people about it and make sure that they don't, aren't the point of failure. So,
absolutely. Social engineering is so much the hardest thing to guard against. We see that, you know, with the business email compromise scams as well. You know, it can be
the hardest thing to prevent. Yeah, I mean, you've seen the losses that have occurred from business email compromise scams, and they are just pure social engineering from start to finish. So, you know, Lapsus, if they continue like this, you know, it's going to be, they could be problematic going forward. Anyway, let's move on, because we have one more thing we wanted to talk about, and that is the Bazaar backdoor malware, who have adopted some new tactics, apparently.
Yeah, so the Bazaar backdoor malware, it's now being spread via website contact forms rather than, or more likely, you know, probably as well as via email, which is how we have primarily seen it being spread up to now, really. And obviously this appears to be an attempt by the group to evade detection by security products. And this report came from researchers at Abnormal Security. So Bazaar backdoor, for those who aren't familiar with it, gives attackers remote access to a network, and it can be used as a launch pad basically for further lateral movement across victim networks, as well as to download other threats such as ransomware. In recent times, I would say it has been most commonly seen being deployed on victim machines prior to ransomware then being downloaded. It is believed to be developed by the same group as the TrickBot botnet and the Conti ransomware, which is a group semantic tracks as Miner. And while Bazaar, as you say, is normally spread via email, Abnormal researchers said they spotted a new campaign in December 2021 where the threat actors with Bazaar backdoor were using corporate contact forms basically to initiate communication with victims. So in one case that was observed by the researchers, the threat actors, they posed as employees at a Canadian construction company who submitted a request for a product supply quote via a contact form. And then after the company responded to the initial query, the attackers used a file sharing service to then share a malicious ISO file supposedly relevant to the negotiation with them. So I guess there is actually, just through speaking of social engineering, there is kind of a social engineering element to this attack as well, really. This ISO archive file attachment then contains a .lnk file and a .log file, and the attackers basically, they're aiming to evade detection by packing the payloads in the archive and then having the user manually extract the payload after they download it, so it won't be prevented from being downloaded. So the LNK file contains a command instruction that opens a terminal window using existing Windows binaries, and then that loads the log file, which is actually the Bazaar backdoor DLL. And Abnormal researchers said that they weren't able to see what the second stage malware downloaded by the backdoor was in this instance. But as we said, Bazaar is most frequently seen being used in ransomware attacks. So that is probably the likely aim of this new attack campaign as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's often a precursor tool. Often, not always, but yeah, if it's one of those things that if you found out your network, alarm bell should start ringing. Okay, let's finish up there. So if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which could be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We're going to be back again in 2 weeks' time. But until then, thank you and goodbye.